I live in Florida, and space travel is our life down here. I used to live for that double sonic boom that we'd get when the shuttles would fly across us. I love it.
Exactly.
And your brand new book, The Thrilling Story of the First Mission to the Moon, Apollo 8, you want to talk about drama. I wonder how many people actually know everything that went on behind the scenes to make sure this went off when NASA wanted it to happen.
Well, that's right. That, I think, one of the things that I really enjoyed writing this book was actually researching that behind-the-scenes work. Because, look, the situation NASA was facing at the time was, it was the summer of 1968. We had about 15 months left before President Kennedy's deadline to get to the moon mm-hmm. by the end of the decade would be met, or would not be met in this case. The Apollo program had come to a grinding halt. A year before, three men had died in the Apollo 1 fire.
Mm-hmm.
So the spacecraft had to be redesigned and rebuilt. The lunar module that would be needed to get down from lunar orbit onto the surface was not remotely flight ready. The Saturn V rocket, the giant missile on which the entire Enterprise rested, was causing all kinds of headaches. They had no time left, and they had to fix all of their hardware. And yet, in that summer of 68, they decided, we are going to throw out our schedule. We're going to kickstart this enterprise, and we're going to get three guys to orbit the moon 16 weeks from now on Christmas Eve 1968. We're going to get them out there. We're going to fire this program back up, and we're going to land on the moon by the summer of 1969. And they did it. But it was getting to the moon for the first time. They flew 233,000 miles out there. Taking nothing away from the Apollo 11 crew that landed for the first time,
mm-hmm.
they just had to close that final 60 miles to get down to the surface.
I do like how part of it happened, pitting MIT against IBM. Low blow.
Exactly. Right towards, in that 16 weeks, one of the biggest challenges was to figure out how to get the software to work properly. You know, we think it's hard to engineer smoothly functioning software now. Back then, they had vastly more primitive tools to work with. So the head, a guy named Bill Tindall, who was the head of the software engineers at NASA, went up to MIT where they did a lot of their work. He basically gathered 400 of the smartest MIT brains and computer engineers in the world, basically locked them inside at Draper Labs and said, you guys have 16 weeks to work this out. And whenever things started to flag, whenever they started to run up against obstacles they couldn't, Tindall would say, all right, well, if you guys can't do it, I can always pick some hot shots from IBM and see if they can come up and lend a hand. And that was usually all it took to motivate the very vain software engineers.
I love that. Now, you spoke with all three astronauts, Frank Borman, Jim Lovell, and Bill Anders. What kind of behind-the-scenes information did they give you that we never heard about?
Well, there was a lot that we never heard about that went on inside the spacecraft. And this was, you know, the spacecraft had, I often describe it as the Watergate tapes, although there was nothing scandalous going on. But in addition to the air to ground, they also had cockpit recorders that were on at all times. And those recordings and transcripts were classified for the first decade or so after they got back from the moon. But now they're openly available. So you could read what was going on inside the spacecraft and listen to it. And a lot of it was as dramatic as you thought it would be. You know, when they first glimpsed the Earth in Earthrise, and that scene of the Earth rising above the moon as they were coming around from the far side, and you hear Borman first saying, oh no, look at that, it's the Earth. Oh man, is that beautiful. And you hear the guys scramble for the cameras. And you hear Bill Anders, who was the photographer, saying to Lovell, get me a color film magazine, because the magazine he had in his camera was black and white. And Lovell's scrambling really quickly, and he reads off a serial number and says, is this the right one? And Anders says, anything, just as long as it's color. So you listen to this drama play out as history is being made. At the same time, in a very funny, very human moment, you also hear Frank Borman, who was the commander of the mission, who knew that his guys were getting fatigued, nobody had slept, order them to go to bed while they were in lunar orbit. They only had 10 orbits. They only had 20 hours, but he insisted, you guys are going to sleep for 2 hours. I don't care about missing 2 hours of sightseeing. So here is the commander. He's got two sons at home. He's no older than Lovell, but he was the commander. Anders was the youngest. And he's actually talking as if he's talking to his kids. He's saying, this conversation is closed. Get your butt to bed. You are going to sleep now. This is really very sweet.
I really love that. They also kept a secret from Houston. Frank Borman had a real issue with space sickness, didn't he?
He did, and they did keep this secret for several hours. He was seriously, almost disablingly ill for 12 hours on the very first day of the mission, and they kept it quiet for about 6 hours, but then were trying to hint to Houston that there was a problem, but Houston wouldn't pick up the hint, and, you know, they wanted to have a secret off-channel conversation with him. In the Mercury and Gemini spacecraft, the ships were so tiny that the astronauts could never really get out of their seats, so they really didn't realize what it was like to move around and experience the nausea that comes from zero-G. The Apollos were the first time people were able to do that. So Borman got very ill on the way out. Now, the danger was nobody knew it was merely space sickness, which is bad enough. They thought that it was either a stomach virus, which in the tiny, confined spacecraft would have inevitably infected the other two astronauts.
Oh, yeah.
Or they also thought that it was radiation poisoning from sailing across the Van Allen belt, the belts of radiation that surround the Earth. No one had ever had to do that before.
Yeah.
Because we'd always stayed in low Earth orbit. So somebody said to the flight surgeon, well, come on, you've always said that, you know, the Van Allen belts, you know, nothing, no more radiation than a chest X-ray. And he answered, yeah, but it's a three-hour chest X-ray because you're sailing, how long it takes to transverse the belts. So that would have been serious because then all three men would have gotten sick, and all three men may well have died of that. But it did turn out just to be space sickness. And, you know, like all motion sickness, this abated after about 12 hours.
This too shall pass. I mean, there's a very serious side to what they were doing, and there was a possibility that they may not have made it back to Earth. How do they feel about that?
Well, each astronaut, I think, approached it differently. They were all aware that they were in a business that could take lives. And again, the death of the Apollo 1 astronauts had made that painfully clear just a year before. But they all approached differently. Lovell, as I always say, was never quite so happy as when he was in space. He was never quite so happy in space as when he was doing something outrageous. So this was fine with him. He just didn't give it any thought. Neither did Borman, but his wife did. Susan Borman was and remains a very tough, very honest woman, and she confronted Chris Kraft, who was the director of flight operations, not long before they left, and she said, look, I want you to tell me the truth. What are their odds of coming back? And he said, you really want to know that, don't you? And she said, I really do, and you know I do. And his answer was, all right, how's 50-50? And she had suspected as much.
Wow.
Bill Anders had a somewhat more nuanced take on things. He thought that his odds were 33-33-33. 33% chance the mission would be completely successful, a 33% chance they would make it home alive, but they would not successfully orbit the moon, and a 33% chance that they would die in the process. And he was willing to fly with those odds.
He's very pragmatic. I know I only have you for another moment. Just a quick question. I was out on the launch pad, out of the Kennedy Space Center. How do you feel about the presence of, you know, commercial industry now as a major part of NASA and our space program?
Well, that's a very good question. I've thought a lot about this. I am generally an enthusiastic supporter of it. I feel that, and I think that, you know, again, this is human nature. One of the things that spurred us to go to the moon was our competition with the Soviets.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if we're no longer, I mean, we're unfortunately in a different kind of competition right now with the Russians, but it's no longer the safe and bracing competition of a space race. Well, if NASA feels like it's in a little bit of competition with the private sector and the egos are on the line, well, that's fine with me. I think it does help spur innovation. I also think it's a very good thing if Boeing and if SpaceX and if other companies can take on the job of flying astronauts to low Earth orbit to the space station, which is what they plan to do starting next year, and if NASA can focus on deep space exploration, going back to the moon, going to Mars. I think that's a good division of labor. The problem is when you have so many people involved and so many different organizations involved, you depend on everything meshing perfectly and being coordinated perfectly. That was very different from the model in the days of NASA when you had one overarching agency under one administrator, supported by one enthusiastic president and backed by a Congress that was willing to cooperate. That's another way to go, but we have nowhere near that kind of coherence in Washington any longer. So it may take a lot of individual pieces working together.
A lot of work to be done. The book is Apollo 8, The Thrilling Story of the First Mission to the Moon. Jeffrey Kluger, thank you so much for your time. You write beautifully, and I just appreciate the behind-the-scenes look at our space program.
Well, thank you for those kind words, and I appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you. We'll look forward to the next book.
Okay. I'm at work on it.
All right. Thank you.